So last week we introduced the Haggadah. We did a few of the paragraphs and gave some explanations of the paragraphs. What I want to do today is continue through the Haggadah with a few other parts, try to explain them and draw some lessons. But before we do that, I want to share with you an interesting thought about matzah, which I just read for the first time recently, which I found to be very interesting. It does relate back to a paragraph we discussed last week. On page 8 of the Maxwell House Haggadahs, page 8 and 9, there's one Haggadah out there that did not conform to the rest, so you can find the page on your own in that one. The Maxwell House, page 8 and 9, so you have on top the paragraph, Halach Ma'anya, this is the bread of affliction, and referring to matzah. So matzah that the Torah refers to by the term Lechem Oni. Lechem Oni, the rabbis give several interpretations of what that word means. Lechem Oni, Lechem is bread. Oni may come from the root word of affliction, like the translation says here. Oni can refer to the word ani, which is somebody who's poor, impoverished. So it's either called the poor man's bread, the bread of affliction. There's another interpretation by the rabbis in the Talmud that oni is similar to the word oneh, which means to respond or to answer, because it's the bread upon which we respond. We answer the Haggadah, answer all the questions over this bread. So that's why we mentioned last week that it sits on the table during the recitation of the Haggadah, so that the entire Haggadah is recited over this bread. That's why we uncover the matzah and we have it there on the table in front of us during the Haggadah. But what I saw that I want to share with you is an interesting understanding of this idea of lechem oni, poor man's bread. And just to discuss at first what that means halachically. So during Pesach, there's really two different forms of matzah which we find. We're familiar with the idea of shmur matzah. And shmur matzah is the
This is not poor man's matzah.
It's certainly not poor man's matzah. You don't find bread that more expensive than that, that's for sure. Shmur matzah is the concept that the matzah used at the night of the Seder to fulfill your mitzvah of eating matzah. Every single Jew has a mitzvah. They must eat matzah the night of the Seder. And that matzah, the matzah used must be shmur matzah. Shmur matzah, the word shmur means it is guarded, which means that it has been guarded for the sake of the mitzvah from harvesting. So that as soon as they harvest that wheat, they are guarding that wheat for the sake of the mitzvah. They're kneading it for the sake of the mitzvah. They're baking it for the sake of the mitzvah. Everything's done for the sake of the mitzvah. That matzah is endowed with a certain level of holiness, which is then used for our mitzvah. But that's one rule about matzah. The Torah says, "Ushmartim es matzos." So you have to guard the matzahs. That's where we get that idea from, shmur matzah. But additionally, the matzah used the Seder has to be lechem oni, and simply what it means, the poor man's bread, is that it can only have in it flour and water. Meaning it gets confusing sometimes because we know there's egg matzah on the market. Egg matzah is Ashkenazic custom to refrain from on Pesach. Sephardic Jews, I believe, do eat egg matzah on Pesach, but Ashkenazic Jews customarily refrain from it unless they need it for digestion or if somebody who's weaker and can't chew the real matzah, it's allowed to eat egg matzah on Pesach. It's kosher Pesach, but Ashkenazim, for several reasons, avoid egg matzah and Pesach. But technically, egg matzah is kosher Pesach, and if you were to knead flour and water with oil, or with sugar, or with honey, or with other ingredients, it could be kosher for Pesach. It's not an issue of not being kosher for Passover egg matzah. The first night, so technically, during the daytime, or for the rest of Pesach after the Seders, technically egg matzah could be eaten. Again, Ashkenazim custom is to refrain, but the basic law would be that egg matzah is kosher Passover, which again is why Sephardic Jews would eat it. Somebody who has trouble chewing or digesting matzah is allowed to eat it. But no matter what you do with egg matzah the rest of Pesach, you cannot fulfill your mitzvah of matzah at the Seder with egg matzah. Why is that? Egg matzah is called matzah shir, rich matzah. Why is it rich matzah? Because it's not just flour and water. It has in it eggs and juice. If you were to put sugar or honey or other ingredients in your matzah, that takes on the status of rich matzah as opposed to poor man's matzah. And that cannot be used at our Seder. So the rest of Pesach, again, according to this essential halacha, matzahs kneaded with other ingredients could be okay to eat. Again, custom is to avoid it, but technically it's okay to eat. At the Seder, you cannot fulfill your mitzvah with egg matzah. So for instance, let's say a Sephardic Jew who would eat egg matzah the rest of Pesach, they still cannot have it at their Seder for their mitzvah. Why is that? Again, because it has to be at the Seder lechem oni, poor man's bread. And it cannot be wealthy matzah. And wealthy matzah means not the price tag on the matzah, as we put up before, but it means the ingredients in the matzah. You need to have very simple matzah at your Seder, flour and water, and that's it. Oh, so you're allowed to use other greens. They have oat matzah, they spelt matzah. There are other matzahs available on the market. But they're still simple, just the spelt in the water, just the oats in the water.
Yeah, what's giant this morning? You want to make matzah bread, and it's like 16 million kinds of egg matzah.
Yeah, it's all in the market these days.
And I ended up buying your Michelin matzah.
Yeah, for those who can't eat wheat, so that's the best to use, because that's traditional, and that we're more familiar with how exactly to make the matzahs. If people can't eat wheat, they do sell spelt matzahs and other types of matzahs out there. I do know people who are allergic and do use these types of matzahs.
Yeah.
Perhaps we made, does that bring out the five grains? You can make matzah out of the five grains of Israel, which are wheat, oats, spelt, barley, or rye. Those are all eligible to make matzah out of. You don't find these matzahs too often, but again, they are available when you need them. So that's the idea. So that's the concept. What?
Wheat,
oats, spelt, barley, or rye. Those are the five grains.
And if somebody couldn't eat any of those?
So then you ask the rabbi what to do.
You can't do the mitzvah.
Yeah, so you can't do the mitzvah, but, you know, it really, between the rabbi and the doctor, they figure that one out, you know, so that's what they have to do. That's the idea of poor man's matzah. So the rest of Pesach, technically, wealthy matzah is okay. Again, that's matzah. It's cooked in 18 minutes, but it could be mixed with other ingredients. Again, Ashkenazi comes to avoid that, but that's technically okay. The Seder, though, we must have poor man's matzah. So there's a lot of discussion. Yeah.
The first night Seder?
For both Seders.
For first and second.
Yeah, right.
Okay. Not for the closing nights.
Right, yeah, just for the Seders. And really just for your matzah you have is the mitzvah. Meaning at a certain point in the Seder, we get the step called matzah. We make the blessing, al chilas matzah, and we eat our matzah at that point. That needs to be shmur matzah, and that needs to be poor man's bread. If you want to snack on another matzah during the meal, you can do that technically. If you want to have this normal everyday Meshavitz matzahs out for the meal, you could do that. But when you're doing your actual mitzvah, and you make that bracha, then your mitzvah needs to have shmur matzah and needs to be lechem oni.
So, yeah. Question I just thought about. Does it appear you shouldn't eat matzah a week or two before so you didn't have the
It's based on custom. The Erev Pesach is forbidden to eat matzah.
Okay.
There are different customs leading up to Pesach. Some refrain for a month since Purim, some refrain from the beginning of Nisan, and some don't refrain at all to Erev Pesach. There are different customs out there. So that's just a custom, a family custom, and you work it out with your rabbi what your custom should be. But the customs vary in that. On Erev Pesach, it's forbidden to eat matzah for that reason, because you want to make sure you enter into Pesach with an appetite for your matzah. So if you already had matzah that morning, you're not going to be excited to have matzah that night. As excited as we are for matzah anyways, but at least we should be excited to do our mitzvah as much as we enjoy or dislike the taste of matzah. It's still mitzvah we want to be excited to do. But the question is, well, there are many concepts explaining why we need to have poor man's matzah. What's the idea of poor man's matzah on Pesach night? As referred to in this translation, the bread of affliction, which might remind us of what slaves would have eaten. Slaves don't have enough money to add in sugar or juice or eggs to their matzah. Their matzah would have just been flour and water. But this week I read a deeper explanation, which I found interesting, which is I found this in a Haggadah. There are probably thousands of commentaries on the Haggadah out there. This one's referred to in Hebrew as Yad Mitzrayim, literally the hand of Egypt. It was written by Rabbi Yitzchak Isaac Chaver, who was, you know, a very great Jewish thinker, really in all areas of the Torah, lived in the 1800s, I think in Lithuania, and he has a lot of writings in different areas of the Torah. But this is this Haggadah called Yad Mitzrayim, Rabbi Yitzchak Isaac Chaver. And what he writes is that the night of Pesach for the Jews was a major transition, because we were going from slaves to freedom, but also from just being a normal nation to God's people. That's what happened on Pesach night. We were committing ourselves to a brand new role in life, a brand new mission, which culminates at Mount Sinai, the giving of the Torah, 49 days later, but 50 days later, 7 weeks later. But the idea is that there's a transition happening between being just normal everyday folk to being God's people. So at that point, not only are we making a commitment that we're going to be God's servants, but there has to be a total paradigm shift in how we live our lives. Meaning until that point, like most people, we lived our lives very much focused on things of this world, on our physical pleasures, material gains, making ourselves comfortable and happy within the confines of the physical world. And that's normal and expected, and that's how everybody, you know, initially sets up their life. But God was giving us a message on Pesach. And God was telling us that, you know, when you become my people, your focus has to change. Your focus is not going to be only on your physical creature comforts. Your focus has to be on the spiritual world. You're going to have to eat, because you're human beings. You have to survive. And you're allowed to be comfortable. And you're allowed to enjoy your life. But realize that your focus has to shift. Your focus will not be on the physical world. Your focus will be on the spiritual world. Therefore, the food that I'm commanding you to eat on Pesach night It's not going to be something so lavish and luxurious. It's going to be very basic. Because it's a message to you that from now on, you have to realize that your physical needs should take care of in a basic manner, and what's needed is sufficient for you to be comfortable and survive. But your real focus should be on spiritual goals, loftier ideas, on God, on the Torah, on performing mitzvos. And therefore, the message is, on that very first night, the Seder night, the very first night of Pesach, that's when we became a people. That was the night where God saved us from Egypt, took us out, killed the firstborn of the Egyptians, let our firstborns live. On that night, God says, I'm giving you a message. That I'm going to command you to eat something. And technically, that's the only thing we're commanded to eat, bitter herbs. We're commanded to eat matzah. And then the Pesach sacrifice, you know, in times of the temple, we're commanded to eat as well. But God says, I want you to eat the bread you're going to have. The staple of human life is bread. Don't have luxurious honey challah. Don't make it into a cake. Don't make it into a cookie. Don't add in sugar. Don't add in honey. Nothing of those sorts. Very plain, basic, bare bones bread. And that's going to teach you that your focus from this point onwards should not be on your physical enjoyment, but rather on spiritual goals. That's the message. Now, the rest of Pesach, we're allowed to eat, technically allowed to eat the wealthy matzah. You can take matzah, you can spread cream cheese on it. If you're Sephardic, you can go have a piece of egg matzah. We have matzah cakes and all sorts of other stuff we eat the rest of Pesach. But it's the initial step. It's the paradigm. What's your paradigm? What's your model? Your model has to be a model of focus on the spiritual world and less focus on the physical world. And that's the message, according to Rabbi Yitzchak Eisenhower, of lechem oni, a poor man's bread. The bread is very, very basic, and its ingredients teach us that we should take care of our physical needs in a very basic manner. That's no longer our ultimate goal. It's not what we're striving for. We strive for spiritual goals, higher goals, goals of doing good, being good, reaching out to God, reaching out to others. That's our new mission in life. And that's what occurred. That's the transition which occurred on Pesach night. So that's another message you can find in your matzah. Matzah has many, many messages. That's one interesting message I found this year, which I never thought of before. So I want to share that with you. Yeah, right. Really, matzah is kind of braille. You know, braille, you can find your messages in the matzah. So let's move on to Haggadah. Last week, I think we made it up to page 11, the top paragraph. So I guess we'll continue on from there. We'll try to bring out some points in the Haggadah. So last week we discussed the four questions, and we discussed the response to the four questions, which was Avadim Hayinu, we were slaves in Egypt, now we're free. And then Haggadah went on to discuss that no matter who we are, even if we're learned and wise, and we've gone through this story year after year after year after year, we're still obligated to discuss the story of the departure from Egypt, and all those who expand the telling of the story are counted praiseworthy. That's what we ended with last week. And the idea was that the content of this story is not just the facts, but it's the impact it has upon you. And you have to keep on discussing it and thinking about it, analyzing it, and drawing out more and more lessons year after year because it's so fundamental to our faith. So I want to continue to the next paragraph. Begins and it. It's the second paragraph on page 11 in the Maxwell House Haggadahs. If you have the other Haggadah, you'll find it. And it is related of Rabbi Eliezer, Rabbi Joshua, Rabbi Elazar, the son of Azariah, Rabbi Akiva, and Rabbi Tarfon. They once met on Passover in Bnei Brak, and spoke of the departure from Egypt all that night, until their disciples came and said, Rabbis, the time has arrived to read the morning Shema prayer. So this is a famous story. They're gathering all night long, discussing the Haggadah. This is on Pesach. This is their Seder. And they were so involved and so absorbed in the story, they didn't realize the morning had come. And the students knock on the door and say, you've gone overtime, come on, it's time to go to davening. You know, shul's starting right now, it's time to say Kriya Shema. Time to say the Shema. So that was just the story. Now, what's the message that we're supposed to draw from the story? What's it doing in the Haggadah? And again, every single paragraph of the Haggadah has dozens of explanations to it. This is probably one of the most written upon works we have in Jewish books, for sure. It could be in history. There's so many commentaries on the Haggadah, it's unbelievable. But I think one basic message from the story is, number one, it shows the extent of the mitzvah. This is all the introduction to the Haggadah. And we just said, the more you discuss the story, the more praiseworthy it is. So now we're seeing a model. Look at these five rabbis. They're so absorbed in the story. Not only did they go all night long, but they didn't realize the morning had come. They didn't even know what time it was. They were so lost in the story. They were so absorbed in it. It had overtaken them. And that's how much these events had impacted them, had grabbed them, had somehow just taken hold in their discussions. And they had no reason to stop. They weren't looking at their watches. They weren't looking out the window for the sun. And the students had to stop them and say, you've gone too late. Now there's a deeper message here, which some commentaries point out, which the disciples came in and told them that the time has come to read the morning Shema prayer. That's what they were told. So what's the idea that they discussed the Haggadah until it was time to say Shema? So on a simple level, that means the morning had come, and the morning is obligation to say Shema, and therefore, come outside, go to shul, come say Shema now. Now it's time. But there's a deeper message here, because Shema is what we refer to as the Kabbalah's Olmachus Shema. It's the acceptance of the yoke of heaven upon ourselves. Shema is our commitment to faith in God. Shema is the Jewish national anthem is Shema. That's how you put it. That's our pride. That's our joy. That's our message. That's what we stand for. It's a declaration of emuna, a faith in God. So when it tells you they were analyzing the Haggadah until it was time to say Shema, on a deeper level it means that where did the Haggadah bring them? It brought them to a commitment to emuna, a much deeper faith in God. Yeah. Right.
Was that back then also? Because if that was the case back then, they didn't say the night Shema, so is it possible this had, this was very important because they already had missed it once, or was that not an issue back then?
That's a good question. I mean, they did say Shema twice back then as well, but probably they said Shema before the Seder began, like we would do. We go to Shul before the Seder, uh-huh. We say Shema, and then we go home for the Seder. So probably they did that same thing, I assume. But then the Seder began, and then they kept on going and going and going and going until the morning. But the idea of the Shema being a commitment to faith in God and Emunah is telling you that your Seder should bring you to a new level of commitment to God. So even if we're not going to go all night, and we're not going to need our students to knock on our door and tell us, wake up, no, not wake up, but come on, it's time to go to Shul. But still, our Seder should bring us to a new faith and commitment in God, because the analysis of the story, the discussions, the experience of eating the matzah, eating the maror, of having the festive meal, that whole experience should bring us up to a new level of faith in God. So therefore, we should also end up, maybe not actually saying the Shema at the end of the Seder, but at least the concept of the Shema, the commitment which you have to God within the Shema, that should be the result of our Seder. There's another deeper explanation. This one is written by the Shem Mishmuel, is the name of the book. He was the Rebbe from Sakachev, one of the Hasidic masters, and he writes that when we talk about Shema as Emuna, so Emuna, we've discussed it at length in this class, but Emuna at a certain point is there's something out there that I don't understand, but I have to have faith. We talk about faith. And we have our minds understand God to a certain degree, but at a certain point, we say, this part I don't understand, this I have to say, I believe in God, I have faith in God, and this is the right thing. So the Shem Yishmuel points out that as deep as these rabbis went in discussing the Haggadah, and as much as they got involved intellectually, and they went all night long to the morning, still at the end of the day, there's a line drawn. And as deep as they can go, at a certain point, they said, but it's all Amuna. It all comes down to faith in God. So you can understand God to this much, and this much, and this much, and this much. But ultimately, you're left saying Shema at the end. And Shema is the commitment to Amuna and saying that there's God out there which I don't understand. And as much as I do try to understand it, there are certain parts which I cannot understand. And we'll discuss this concept more when we get to the wise son, because I think the wise son has some of this message as well. We're talking about the four sons. But the Shem Yishmuel writes a deeper point here that these rabbis, as much as they discuss the Haggadah, as much as they intellectually are able to analyze and look into the story, at a certain point, even the rabbis are going to say that we don't understand this about God, and that we'll have to sit back on faith and on Muna and say that that part we don't understand, that part's beyond us. So that's one of the other concepts of the saying the Shema that morning. The next paragraph, Rabbi Elazar, son of Azariah, said, note that I am like a man of 70 years of age, yet I was not able to prove that the telling of the departure from Egypt should be at night, until the son of Zoma proved it from the following words of Scripture. So just to paraphrase, there is an obligation daily of remembering the Exodus. We know that we have to remember the Exodus of the Seder, that's what it's all about, but we actually have a daily obligation twice a day to remember the Exodus, in morning and night. Now we happen to include that in the Shema. The last paragraph of the Shema also mentions, I am the Lord your God took you out of Egypt. And that's how we fulfill that mitzvah. So it's kind of built into our prayers. So you don't have to do it separately. If you say the Shema, it's included in the Shema. But there is a mitzvah daily to remember the Exodus. So Rabbi Elazar, the son of Azariah, said that I could never prove there was a nightly obligation. I knew there was a daily obligation, but I never had any proof that there should be a nightly obligation until the son of Zoma proved it to me. And what the son of Zoma say? He quoted from a scripture that you may remember the day of your going out of Egypt all the days of your life. The Torah says you should remember leaving Egypt all the days of your life. So he says that the days of your life refers to the days, but when you say all the days of your life, that includes nighttime as well. I mean, this is a typical way that the Talmud would derive Jewish law, which is that you look at one extra word in the Torah, it tells you a whole addition upon the halacha. So the Torah says, remember every single day the Exodus. But the terminology used is remember it all the days of your life. The word all is inclusive. So what does it mean all days of your life? It means even nighttime as well. So every day and every night you have to remember the Exodus. The sages, however, say, but Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah noted that the sages disagree with this, and they said the days of your life refers to the world only, to this world only, but all the days of your life includes the time of the Messiah. I mean, the sages would tell you, you don't have to remember Shema every single night. You don't have to remember the Exodus every single night. You throw the Exodus only during the daytime. But this mitzvah will still apply when the Mashiach comes. When the Mashiach comes, we'll still have to remember the Exodus from Egypt. And that's what the sages say. So you end up with a dispute between Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah and the sages. Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah would tell you that he has to remember the Exodus at night, but not the times of Mashiach. Once the Mashiach comes, that's going to overshadow the Exodus. So we don't need to remember the Exodus anymore. The sages are going to tell us that you don't have to remember the Exodus at night, but you do have to remember the Exodus at the time of the Mashiach. That's what they're saying. Yeah.
Are the sages really saying you're not obligated to remember it, to mention it at night, or are they only saying that this verse is not the source?
No, but this verse is the only source discussed. So if this verse doesn't have a source for it, then they're saying, you know, there's no obligation at night. That's what they would say.
Would we say then that the sages didn't Kriya Shema at night?
Well, they would say Kriya Shema, but they didn't have to remember the Exodus. I mean, they could cut out that line technically. I mean, they don't need that line.
Right. So
this is not impacting Kriya Shema, this is impacting just remembering the Exodus. So that's the paragraph. Now we have to ask the question again. It's a very technical paragraph. It's dealing a lot with halacha, but what's the message for us in the middle of our Haggadah? I mean, the mitzvah of Pesach night is to tell the story of the Exodus. And until now, we were discussing the story, we're discussing how to discuss the story, and the power of the story, and what's our model of how to get absorbed in the story. But now we're discussing seemingly a detail which is not relevant to the Seder. By the way, you should know the Seder is not the only time to mention the Exodus. You need to mention it daily as well. That's what this paragraph's telling you. So why is this paragraph in our Haggadah? So I would say that when the Haggadah is telling us and noting that there is a daily mitzvah and nightly mitzvah, according to Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, to remember the Exodus, it's trying to show us how essential the Exodus is to Jewish faith. That's what it's showing us. Don't think that this discussion is only limited to the date of the 15th of Nisan, the day you left Egypt, on Pesach. Realize that this discussion is something that's relevant every day of your life. Because if we didn't have this paragraph, we might think, well, it's important to discuss it tonight because it's the Seder and this is the night that we actually left Egypt. Who says it's something which has to impact my entire year? For instance, we have no mitzvah to remember Purim all year long. We just celebrated Purim. So on Purim, we talk about Purim. We talk about Esther and Mordechai and Haman, but now we're a week and a half after Purim, and it's not on our minds anymore, as far as I know. Not on our minds anymore. Chanukah, we have 8 days of Chanukah, and we discuss the story of the Maccabees and the Greeks. Chanukah ends. Okay, so it was during that time of year, it's important to note such a miracle. But I don't have to note it today, and that's something in my mind. But the Exodus is so essential that even though the miracle only occurred during Pesach, on the 15th of Nisan, we have to remember it daily, because these are fundamental ideas of Judaism which cannot be forgotten any day of your life. Whether it be day or day and night, it's still a daily obligation. It doesn't matter if we go to the sages or Rabbi Elazar, either way we're remembering it daily, that's for sure. The question is it twice a day or once a day? But certainly it's something which is relevant daily. So it's focusing us in. Before we begin the story, the Haggadah is saying, realize how fundamental this is to daily life for a Jew. You cannot forget this message day in and day out, because this discussion we have at Seder night is going to give us the long version of the story, but that long version should impact you, and therefore every day when you think about the short version of the story, when you just mentioned God took me out of Egypt every single day, it has to, the message has to sit with you. The message has to impact the way you act in your life and the way you live your life day in and day out. Even to the point where, according to the sages, we have to remember the Exodus, the times of the Mashiach. I mean, the Gemara has a discussion about this, and the Gemara quotes verses and tells us that the miracles of the final redemption, the times of the Mashiach, are going to be on a greater level than the miracles of the Exodus. So therefore, we might think, well, it should overshadow the Exodus. Like Rabbi Elazar seems to say, he would tell you don't have to remember the times of the Mashiach, because the miracles of the final redemption are going to be so great Well, see, Egypt, that was nothing. The final redemption, that's what we have to talk about. But the sages are telling you, no, even though the final redemption will be so great, and the salvation will be so incredible, and the revelation of God at that point is going to be so intense and powerful, you still can't forget about Egypt, because the fundamental ideas of the Torah that are revealed in Egypt, those are timeless, and those continue on even after the Mashiach comes. This paragraph is giving us a real focus, just to tell us how weighty this story is, and how important the story is for every single Jew. So that's I guess that's the end of the introduction, and now we get into, I would say, another introduction. But if you look at the Haggadah happens to be very structured. It's hard to figure out the structure sometimes, and that could be classed on its own. Until now, we kind of introduced the idea of telling the story. Now we're going to discuss the four sons. That's the next part of the Haggadah, which is introducing how to get the story across to every type of person. I mean, until now, it's concepts of what's this story all about, why is it so important, how do we tell the story, when should we tell the story, but now we're getting more into the methodology. And the four sons, we'll talk about that in a minute, but the four sons really is the method of how the story should be given over and should be presented to people at our seders. So let's look at the next paragraph. It's a little short paragraph there. Blessed be the omnipotent, blessed be the giver of the law to the people of Israel. So this translation is very much a paraphrase, not literal. I'll tell you that. The Hebrew, let's look at the Hebrew. Baruch HaMakom, blessed is the Makom. The word Makom literally means place, and it's used as the name of God. It's the name of God we don't use too often. We're familiar with it when we comfort mourners. May the Makom, literally the place. I think the best translation would be the omnipresent, not the omnipotent. I don't know why it says omnipotent here. Omnipotent means all powerful. Omnipresent is constantly all over, everywhere. But Baruch HaMakom, God is called the place. Why is God called the place? So the rabbis point out that, I have to say this clearly, we don't say that the world is God's place. Rather, it's hard to get over it in English because the rabbi's saying kind of a. We don't say that the what? We don't say that the olam is makomo shel kodesh baruch hu. The world is not God's place. Rather, the place of the world is God. Did I say that clearly? The world is not God. God doesn't exist in our world, but the world exists in God. That's what the rabbis say. I mean, God is the place of everything. God is the setting in which everything exists. Right?
It takes time.
Yeah, you have to let it click for a second. The world is not God's place, rather the place of the world is God. That's what the rabbis say. The world is not God's place, rather the place of the world is God. Meaning that we don't say there's a world and God comes into the world. We say there's a God and the world exists in God. That's what we say. God is infinite. And within that infinite God, there's a place for our world to exist. Rather than saying that the world exists and God comes into our world. That's the concept. That's what we refer to God as the makom, the place.
That's for each language.
Yes. but we got that. Everyone gets that point? That's translating it. And even the Hebrew it takes a second to click in. But
what makes it more, they say God is with you all the time.
God's with you all the time. Yeah, because we're all existing within God. Right. Yeah, the world is. Again, the world is not. God doesn't go into the world, or the world is in God. That's the concept. Again, it's a deep concept. But that's where this name Makom comes from. The God is called the place. Because the place where. The world is not our place. Really, the world's place is in God. That's how we view it. This is Baruch Hu. Blessed be He. Baruch Shnasan Torah Lamo Yisrael. Blessed is the one who gave the Torah to his nation Israel. Baruch Hu. Blessed be He. So you can see the English is very much a paraphrase of the Hebrew. It's not a translation at all, in my mind. But that's the introduction now to the four sons. It's interesting to note that there's four phrases in the Hebrew, and commentators point out those correspond to the four sons. So we have the wise son, the wicked son, the simple son, and the one who does not know how to ask. So Baruch HaMakom, that refers to the wise son. Because the wise son has the ability to recognize that God is infinite. So Baruch HaMakom, blessed be the place, that would line up with the wise son. Baruch Hu, blessed be he, that's a statement which is much less intricate, much more simple. whoever God is, he should be blessed. And that's the statement that corresponds to the simple son. Baruch Shas Torah L'Amo Yisrael. Blessed is the one who gives Torah to his people Israel. That corresponds to the wicked son. Because the wicked son, we know that he says, what's this service mean to you? And the Agada says that he's kind of withdrawn himself from the community. So he excludes himself. So when you say, blessed is the one who gave Torah to his people Israel, is saying, I'm not included in that. Because the wicked son excludes himself from being part of Israel. And then Baruch Hu, again, the fourth phrase corresponds to the son who's not allowed to ask. That's, again, the more simple, basic blessing of God. Blessed be he. Whatever God is, he should be blessed. So those four phrases do correspond to the four sons. Now this, again, is a kind of a random insertion to the Gada, just a random praise of God. And all the commentaries ask, what's this doing here? Now, as he's pointed out, it does introduce the four sons. But also, this is looked at as a blessing upon Torah study. We know there's a concept to make a blessing upon Torah study. It's part of our morning prayers to make a blessing on Torah study, to make a blessing prior to reading the Torah. And now, when we're about to tell the story of the Exodus, which is Torah study, there's kind of a miniature blessing of the Torah, which occurs right before we begin the story. This blessing was interesting because it happens to be a blessing of the Torah, but it also highlights the four sons. And I've heard explained before that it gives you a very interesting understanding of the Torah, which is that we pointed out, I think, maybe a month ago, 2 months ago, we pointed out that there's something very unique about the Torah, which is it's really the one book that applies to every single person, every single level. Whether you're a five-year-old kid, whether you're 95 years old, whether you're learned, whether you're a beginner, whether you're intermediate, whether you're a man, whether you're a woman, no matter who you are, the Torah has a message for you. And that same exact book of the Torah, which the five-year-old kid begins in school, you have the learned sage who's 90 years old, learning the same exact book. So Torah is the one book which really can apply to every type of person. So we're blessing the Torah in a way, in lining up with the four sons, by saying the Torah has a message for every single son. Whether you're wise, whether you're wicked, whether you're simple, whether you're the one who doesn't know how to ask, no matter who you are, the Torah is a message for you. And that's introducing to us the Torah, praising the Torah in its how it's so versatile, and its messages are so diverse. And it also introduces to us the story of the Exodus, in that it's now going to we're going to lead into learning Torah right now, the Torah study. That's what we're about to do. But before we get to the Torah study, the Haggai continues and tells us that there's four sons. The law speaks, the next paragraph, the law speaks distinctly of the four different sorts of children: the wise, the wicked, the simple, and the one who's not allowed to inquire. Those are the four. Where do these four sons come from? People don't realize this. There's actually four places where the Torah speaks about the mitzvah of telling the story of Exodus to your children. Four different places. But every place the Torah discusses it, it words the mitzvah differently. So the rabbi said, the Torah is teaching us a lesson. There's four different ways of presenting the story, because there's four different sons asking the question, and there's four responses to them. So we find the four sons are actually verses in the Torah itself, the four sons. This Haggadah does not quote the verses, but a lot of Haggadahs will actually quote for you where each verse is found in the Torah. Every question asked here is found somewhere in the Torah, introducing the mitzvah of telling the story of the Exodus of Pesach night. So that's where, that's where the four sons come from. Now there's many understandings of who these four sons are. I mean, what does it mean to be wise, or wicked, or simple? You know, it's very popular to look at all the old Haggadahs and see the pictures which are in them. You know, probably everyone's seen different Haggadahs throughout the ages. I think there have been exhibits made out of this, and how every single culture and different generations depict who's wise and who's wicked and who's simple. Because really, the idea, the image we have in our minds of who's simple or who's wise is very influenced by our society, by our lives. So you have Haggadahs throughout the ages which have pictures, and they really depict these people very differently. So it's a fascinating, if you haven't seen, I think there's different exhibits and books put together on this. It's a very interesting thing. But I like the explanation of the Maharal. The Maharal explains, who are these four sons? And one of the great things about the Maharal's commentary in general is that the Maharal always tries to say, when the rabbis speak in numbers, they're trying to be all-inclusive. I mean, every type of person will be included in these four sons. Because if we take it simply, there's someone wise, someone wicked, someone simple, someone's going to ask, you might be able to think of some other types of people in there. But the way the Maharal describes it, it's talking about four different approaches to wisdom, he says. What does it mean to be wise? It doesn't say this child is righteous. And we're not necessarily talking about his mental capabilities. Also, a wicked person is not the opposite of a wise person. You could be wise, and we would say it's somebody who is stupid. I mean, I say, you know, whatever it is, somebody who's not as wise. Someone wicked and wise are not opposites. So, what does it mean to be wise or wicked? So the Maharal says, somebody wise, it means somebody who is actively pursuing knowledge. We're not discussing mental capabilities here. We're discussing some people are actively pursuing knowledge. They're curious, they want to know more, they want to develop ideas, they want to analyze ideas, they always want to know more and more and more. So it's someone we would call a knowledge seeker, someone who's curious. That's the chacham, that's the wise person. So it's not saying what's his IQ, what he got on the SATs, but saying it's an attitude towards wisdom. So the wise son has an attitude towards wisdom that I always want to know more and more and more. I'm going to proactively ask questions and seek out information. The Rasha, the wicked son, the Maharal explains, is similar to the wise son in that he's proactively finding information. But the problem with the wicked son is that he has an agenda. And he only wants the information in order to use it against you. So the wise son is intellectually honest, he's seeking truth, and he wants to take all the information and understand it. The wicked son already has his opinion. He's not interested in your answer in terms of truth-seeking. He wants to know what you have to say so he can twist it and use it against everything you stand for. That's the wicked son wants. Which is actually found, as I said, every single one of these sons has a source in the Torah. And the text of the Torah, which describes the wicked son, when it comes to the other sons, the word used is ki yishalcha. They ask you a question. When it comes to the wicked son, it says ki yomru aleichem eichem, when your sons tell you. Because they're not asking. They're telling you. I mean, that might be saying in the form of a question, but they already know what they want to say, the wicked son. So when the Torah describes the wise son, it's ki yishalcha bincha machor, when your son asks you the question. Because the wise son wants to know. He sincerely wants to understand the information. Even the simple son, he wants to know. He may not be so intricate in his question, but he wants to understand. The wicked son, ki yomru aleichem eichem, when your sons say to you, they declare to you, what are you doing this all for? It's a declaration. I mean, they're not interested in the answer. Yeah, they'll take the answer just to twist it and use it against you, but they don't really want to know the answer. So the Torah is very precise in how it describes the wicked son. The Maharal says the simple son is somebody who, if you pique his curiosity, he'll ask a question, but he's not proactively seeking knowledge. So at the Seder, we do many things which we try to induce questioning. And I guess that would be aimed at somebody who's like the simple son, who's not going to ask unless you somehow urge them to ask. So the Tom who's simple, it doesn't mean that he's stupid, doesn't mean that he doesn't understand things, he's just not interested in seeking out knowledge. He might be very wise, he might be smarter than the Chacham, the wise son, in terms of his IQ. But he's not somebody who's proactively seeking out wisdom all the time. And that's the simple son. And then the She'eno Yodea Lishol, so the Maharal says, very different. He's not somebody, you know, usually the picture of this is like a baby, or like some kid who's just totally clueless, doesn't know what he wants. Maharal says it's somebody who's disinterested. Any day Lishol doesn't mean he doesn't know how to ask, it means he's not interested in asking. So in some ways, he's just as distant as the wicked son, or even worse. The wicked son is at least involved. The wicked son is somebody who's there. He may have his own agenda, he may have his own opinion, he may try to twist your words against him. But he's asking. He's seeking knowledge. The simple son, you know, if you pique his curiosity, we'll enter the discussion. The Inu De Elishol could be an adult, could be a very wise adult, could have a very, very high IQ. But the Inu De Elishol, the one who does not know how to ask, it means he is not interested. It means he's just totally disinterested. There's the cute saying which you found that many outreach organizations have. There's that fifth son who didn't show up to the Seder. Right? It was the fifth son who didn't show up to the Seder at all. He was totally alienated from Judaism. And the Rabbi will tell you it's actually the fourth son. He's the one who's just totally disinterested. He doesn't care to be there. He doesn't care what you have to say. Even if you pique his curiosity, he just doesn't matter to me. That's the fourth son according to Maharal. But those are your four sons. So the four sons, it's not a measure of IQ, it's not a measure of age, it's not a measure of righteousness per se, but what it is, it's an attitude towards wisdom. Are you proactively seeking wisdom? Will you appreciate it if your curiosity is piqued? Maybe you're going to take the wisdom and turn it against others, or maybe you're totally disinterested. Those are your four sons according to the Maharal. So we're out of time for this week. So God willing, again, next week I won't be here. In 2 weeks, we'll try to discuss the discussions with the four sons. Who are these four sons? What's the question? What's the answer? That'll be the four sons. But it's important to note that each of these four sons, it's all a method of how to get across the message of Torah to all different kinds of people. Because at our Seder, everyone's different. Every person approaches the Seder differently. Everybody has different levels of knowledge, different levels of interest. And the Torah and the Seder are a message for every single Jew out there. Even the one who's disinterested, even the one who has an agenda to come up against you, the Seder's message is that one as well. So God willing, in 2 weeks, we'll try to discuss the message given to each of these 4 sons.